This is D.W. Calvert speaking. This is the first day of February 1982. I'm in the Velvet Folk Inn in Raleigh, North Carolina, with a longtime friend and co-worker, Dr. Walton Gregory. That's W-A-L-T-O-N, isn't it? Dr. Gregory has been involved in scientific research and teaching at North Carolina State University for a long period of time, has been honored for many of his outstanding accomplishments, and is now retired. Walton, it's good to see you again. Would you begin our conversation by telling us where you were born and where you went to school and what got you into the field of agriculture?
Well, that's accident in part, of course, because I had nothing to do with to whom and where I would be born. But I was born in Amherst, Virginia, which is a county just north of the James River, bordering Lynchburg. And our home was on the west side of the county seat, up against the foothills, just east of the Blue Ridge mountain range there. And so each morning when we awakened, there were the rising hills and the mists and trees of the Virginia Blue Ridge to inspire us for the day.
Sounds almost like Ashe County.
Keep yes, on. It does. Very, not very different.
Where I grew up.
And I went through the usual experiences of a small boy growing up in the Red Hill district of Piedmont, Virginia, and not too fertile soils, and not too good a lay of the land for agricultural purposes. And we grew some cattle, produced some milk, and produced some grain and fodder and forage for the animals on a small plot of land lying there east of the Blue Ridge. And of course, as I grew up, I was born in 1910, and my first memories have to do with the quaking comments of the adults about the impending Great War of 1914 to 18, and I of course went through the experiences of the pre-war years until I was 8 years old, and then following those years, the impact of the 20s on a rural and backward place where automobiles were something to stand on the side of the road to look at, and airplanes were a rarity that occasionally appeared overhead, much to the consternation of the local populace. But then, of course, came the high school years and the beginning of the Great Depression, and with the crash in 1929. Of course, I was a Methodist. My family was a Methodist. And we were fundamental religious beliefs, and when the droughts came, we thought that praying for rain would help, and the droughts came, especially in 1930. I remember the corn never tasseled in the field. It turned white and looked like snow in the moonlight, and died standing there without ever making a shoot. And acres of forest land on some of the thinner soils overlying the rocks there on those hills died of the drought. And in the succeeding years, of course, next 2 or 3 years, the sun was whitened by the dust from the west. And poverty was a thing that the definition of poverty today makes one smile. But nevertheless, all my beginnings were rural. Plants and animals were my companions and experience. And as I matured and as I went through one of the worst years that I can imagine, when cattle, beef cattle on the foot, were being shipped east out of the dry lands and dumped into railroad corrals, where we tried to buy a few to grow them out on the thin grass that was growing in our dry terrain.
That would have been 1931.
That would be in 1930 and 31. And cattle, if I may have the timing a little bit off, but with regard to price, but I remember that at the bottom, they were cows for the beef market were at 4 cents a pound on the hoof, and fairly decent animals were 8 cents a pound. And the total income for my family at the bottom of that economic hole was 500 cash dollars 1 year.
How many members of your family?
There were in the house, there were the grandfather, 7 children, and 2 parents.
Did you take vocational agriculture?
I did and I didn't. We had a very weak vocational agricultural program at our high school, just beginning at that time. And our school college at that time at Blacksburg had begun to send out a few trained people to at the county level. And I remember the first county agent that came to our county. It was a phenomenon and a novelty that we looked at with some wonderment as to just what in the world he was supposed to be doing. And we did have a single vocational agricultural teacher at the high school with a high school shop. And we had some, before I became grown, we had occasional 4-H projects that were...
But you were not too much involved in the vocational...
But my teachers suggested that I take the college preparatory route, which avoided the, and conflicted at that time, with the vocational agriculture route, which was a mistake.
You probably got more science courses, though, that way.
Well, we got chemistry, but we more got Latin and French and things like, and mathematics and things like that, in place of the shop work that we would have done with the vocational program.
Now, what year did you graduate from high school?
Well, Dean, I have to admit that I never graduated from high school. I quit to work for a year in a low period there, and cleared some land that was growing, that had grown up in brush, and planted the corn to try to increase our forage output. And found that when I tried to go back to high school, that time had changed things to a considerable extent. And I inquired as to the possibility that I might have enough credits to enter college without ever finishing high school. And believe it or not, I inquired at a school in nearby Lynchburg College, who sent a recruiter out to see me, a very amiable and I think able man, who introduced me to the biology professor at Lynchburg. And they both talked to me about my problems of needing a high school diploma to get into college, and they suggested
that I might, if I took the entrance examinations that were then required and placement examinations that were advised, to see just what level of operation that you would attempt in the courses of the freshman year there, that I might be admitted without the diploma. And I went over in the fall of the year and took a whole battery of tests, which I have no idea what purpose they served, but I took them nevertheless and was admitted.
To Lynchburg College?
At the Lynchburg College, where I graduated in 1934.
You graduated with
a Bachelor of Arts degree.
Bachelor of Arts
and
degree.
I had majored in biological sciences and taken some chemistry and mathematics and things like that as a backup to the biology.
And then where did you go after you graduated?
I got a small stipend of some $200, I think it was. As a scholarship to give me a chance to attend the University of Virginia. And I attempted to do a master's program there. But meantime, and I should not leave this out of this story, the medical doctor who was present at my birth called me in one day to his office, and he says, "I hear from your father that you have a scholarship to go to Charlottesville, to the University of Virginia." And I said, "That's true, but it's so small, I don't know whether I'll be able to go or not." And he said, "Well, you go ahead and I will forward you the money to proceed. And I'll start off by giving you $500, which you can pay back to me. And I have this money," I suppose he said, "in escrow, to help any able graduate at Amherst High School who will use it to go through school, pay it back when he gets through. And I've made this a program of my own," which is the kind of thing that happens all the time in the United States and doesn't get into Mr. Reagan's propaganda book, but it does happen. And this man, whom no doubt someone had helped in his early years, was helping young people get a start in the world, and he helped me. And I graduated with a master's degree at the university the next year, by the way, in ecology rather than in agriculture or forestry or any, but in biology nevertheless. But the slant was toward botany already and away from zoology. And the next year I attended George Washington University on a teaching scholarship. And the following year I found an opportunity to get a DuPont fellowship with the University of Virginia to study genetics and cytogenetics at the Blandy Experimental Farm, which was located near Winchester, Virginia, and directed by Dr. O.E. White. And, of course, my biology professor, Ruskin S. Freer, is still living, by the way.
Freer, how do you spell that?
F-R-E-E-R. He's still living at on Timberlake Shore, there near Lynchburg, in his 80s. And it would be impossible to say how much of an influence this man had on my life. We were a small school at Lynchburg, and I was almost his daily companion, and therefore I had a private tutor in materials that went far beyond the scope of the school itself.
Now, what was the nature of your work at the station?
And when I went on to the Blandy Farm,
excuse me, yeah.
Dr. White, an interesting man himself, was born in a sod house in Iowa and attended college at Brookings South Dakota. And he went from there to Harvard University and studied genetics under the great E.M. East, who, by the way, had started his life as a physical chemist and ended appropriately in genetics. And Dr. White then went from Harvard to Brooklyn, Botanic Garden, and from Brooklyn Botanic Garden to U.S. Department of Agriculture for a while, and then from back to the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and from there to the University of Virginia, as a challenge to take this farm, which had been donated to the university, and develop it into something worthwhile as a teaching and research institution. And during his years there, he graduated a number of very able men. It was my good opportunity to have a chance to work with some of those early.
How long were you there?
Let's see, I graduated with a PhD from Virginia in 1940. And my commencement address was the famous stab in the back speech by Franklin Roosevelt. I remember this partly because of it. It was such an outstanding occasion, and I'm reminded of it by the fact that he's been in the newspapers this week on his 100th anniversary. So from there, to find a job was quite a challenge, and I finally located a place at Tennessee Polytechnic Institute at Cookeville, Tennessee, where I worked 2 years. And in August of my second year, I got a telephone call from Ralph Cummings, head of agronomy department at North Carolina State University, and asked me if I would come over for an interview, that he had a position he was trying to fill as an assistant to the corn breeder, Dr. P.H. Harvey, who was in charge of the hybrid corn development at that time in North Carolina State.
How did Dr. Cummings know about you?
Well, Dr. Cummings had put out an inquiry to several institutions, and I'm not sure just what procedure he followed in doing this, but probably a routine procedure to cover the ground. And it came to the attention of Dr. O.E. White, my major professor. And Dr. Cummings told me that it was the long handwritten letter from Dr. White that attracted him to me and over there in what was then just a small school on the plateau, Cumberland Plateau in East Tennessee.
Would you regard it as a little bit unusual that Dr. Cummings would have gone to an organization more or less out of the mainstream of land-grant research functions? What do you think caused him to respond? He undoubtedly had names from a lot of other people. He didn't know Dr. White particularly well, I take it.
He was not personally acquainted with Dr. White, but Ralph Cummings was not and is not a person who whose horizons are limited by any particular professional class that you might think of as agriculture or law or mathematics. So these lines have to be recognized in filling positions, it is true, but he was a wise enough individual to realize that plant breeding and genetics were intimately related, and that botany and cytogenetics were intimately related to genetics, and that plant improvement was a complex front which could be contributed to by more than people who had just been trained in agronomy.
I'm sure this would be speculative on your part or mine, but do you think it's possible that Dr. Cummings might have been looking for a means of broadening the land-grant base or getting outside the normally recognized framework and puncturing a frontier that would not have arisen within the framework?
I can readily believe that he would have been doing that, especially since he had been at Cornell at the time that he was. And he knew something about the horticultural program there at Cornell and the agronomy program there, and the broad approach that university was making toward botanical science in general, and the relationship of those broad approaches to the practical improvement of plants. It was most evident at that time with people like Rhodes and McClintock and Randolph.
McClintock.
Right. Very famous person who
benefited the transcriber.
Whom, if I were on the committee, would receive the Nobel Prize for her effort.
Okay, you came to NC State then in what year?
I think it was the fall of 42, but that was a long time ago, and I'm not.
And you came as an assistant to Dr.
I just came in what would now be classified as a technical assistant. Not a very, at that time, it was not thought of as a very poor position, but at the same time, it wasn't thought of as a part of the professorial lineage.
That is, you didn't start as an assistant professor.
No, I came as an agent of the Federal Department of Agriculture.
And you were paid by the...
I was paid by the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Let me ask you a question right at this point. There's a great tendency on the part of many of us who have watched the development of the School of Agriculture to say that the big turning point was when Baver and Salter came and so on, but something else must have happened because Paul Harvey was here before they came, and Paul was regarded as the young, well-trained scientist at that time. Do you know what brought Paul Harvey here?
I am not sure, but of course Paul graduated, of course, with Lindstrom at Iowa in genetics, and he was out of the mainstream himself in the sense of agronomy. He was not an agronomy major. And
well, I think the truth of the matter is that some new federal funds played a major role here. But I think that it causes us to have to say that all of the highly skilled scientists were not brought here after Salter and Baver came.
Right. I think that possibly the war had a good deal to do with the insistence of broadening the at that time well-recognized impact of hybrid corn out of the Midwest to the South.
Okay. What did you do when you first came to work with Dr. Harvey?
Well, the first thing I learned to do was to shell corn and keep it in small packages and do an assistant's work while I became acquainted with the main objectives of the program. Later, I was able to contribute to the program by introducing ideas on what might be called a geometric approach rather than an algebraic approach to combining ability and corn hybrids, which were later made very well known by Ralph Comstock and Robinson in some of their work on convergent
hybridization in that area. I had no chance to make an effective research impact in corn because about the time I was discussing these ideas with Dr. Harvey with the notion of maybe developing a little sub-project with him, that Dr. Cummings came and asked me if I would join the staff as an assistant professor and take over the peanut breeding program.
Well, I know that the peanut program has been one that you've had a number of involvements in and have achieved a considerable distinction in. Tell us about the situation with regard to peanuts in the state about that time.
Well, it's interesting that the impact of all this activity at the agricultural experiment station had yet to be felt on the farms of North Carolina. And corn yields on the upper coastal plain land was about 30 bushels per acre when well managed. And peanut yields were around 1150 to 1200 pounds per acre. And of course, this is rock bottom production for peanuts. They will produce around 1100 to 1200 pounds on soils of suitable texture, without added increments of fertilizer or advanced scientific management almost anywhere in the world. It seems to me that some of the poorer producers at that time, producing anywhere from 500 to 900 pounds per acre, almost had to make the effort to produce so few peanuts per acre, possibly because of poor stands.
Well, did you begin your work in the breeding field, or did you work in, more broadly in the total cultural relationships with peanuts?
Well, at the time, Dr. Middleton had been in charge of the peanuts, and his program in grain breeding was expanding, and he needed to be relieved of the peanut program.
So that actually, let's see if we get this straight now. Actually, about the time you took over the peanut program, this meant that Dr. Harvey devoted himself exclusively to hybrid corns,
right,
and Dr. Middleton exclusively to small grains.
As soon as I took the peanuts, he
yes.
was able to do that,
right,
and which gave them much greater strength in those two crucial crops. In the case of the peanuts, we were doing work at that time on plant populations per acre and the relationship of varieties such as there were to plant density.
What was the best variety, or one of the best varieties at that time?
Well, there were several farm selections selected by farmers. And in the Perquimans area, White's Runner was...
Named for somebody by the name of White?
Right, Mr. White's peanut. And in Virginia, just north of there, Atkins Runner. And it's still an excellent peanut, really. These peanuts, these people did something when they selected the best among their own somewhat mixed up stocks, while they selected the best. And in so doing, they made some progress in plant breeding. So, and plant breeding has a history of having been started by the farmers and growers themselves, not necessarily by scientists. It's only in recent years that scientists began to do something with plant breeding.
Well, as a scientist entering into this new field that you suddenly had responsibility for, what did you start doing?
Well, my first observation was epitomized by a remark made by the famous student of Dr. Muller in genetics, of Dr. Morgan, excuse me, in genetics, and that was Sturtevant. And
say that word again.
Sturtevant is a Dutch name.
Sturtevant, S-T-U-R-D-I-V-A-N-T.
T-E-V-A-N-T.
Spell it, though.
S-T-U-R-T-E-V-A-N-T. And he was visiting North Carolina State as a seminar speaker at that time, and
he asked me what in the world that I elected to work with peanuts. He was thinking from a geneticist point of view, because of their lack of variation. So they have no variability. Well, the truth of the matter is that he was speaking from the limited point of view of the peanuts that existed in the United States at that time. And true, they didn't have very much variability. And that they had been exploited fairly successfully by people like Mr. Knight of Martin County, when he produced Martin County Runner, and Mr. White, when he produced White Runner, and Mr. Atkins, when he produced Atkins Runner. And later, of course, the selection work done by the scientists at North Carolina State University, which is a first step in any plant improvement program, is to take the land race that exists and find what is in it that is worthwhile and make use of that while you are doing things that take longer to finish. And Dr. Middleton had selected NC4, which was a superior strain selected out of a final base of about 100 lines developed out of a North Carolina bunch peanut grown in the upper coastal plain.